Case number 13-7081, Alan J. Bauer, Dr. Appellant v. Mavi Marmara, all and all the right, title and interest therein et al. Mr. Perlin for the appellant, Mr. Schenker for the appellee.
May it please the court. I want to preface by telling the court what we're not looking for, what we're not arguing in this appeal. First, we're not arguing that, under federal statutes that are silent as to a private right of action, that give no indication as to whether there is such a right, a federal court should reach out and create such a right. We're not arguing that that courts create a private right of action under criminal statutes, and we're not arguing that courts create a private right of action that would interfere with the United States foreign affairs. What we are arguing is that the court should issue a very narrow ruling on informer statutes that do not give any indication on their face whether they do or do not provide a private right of action, that they are to be construed to provide one. Before I go on, I also want to clarify what we're talking about when we say an implied right of action. I think there are two different connotations when we talk about an implied right of action. The first connotation is the one that sets off bells. That's where you have a statute that is absolutely silent and is just a general statute, gives no indication, might prohibit certain conduct, and doesn't say anything about an informer, doesn't say anything about a private individual. In those cases, the courts have consistently held for the last 40 years that a private party does not have a right of action, and we don't take issue with those cases. The other connotation of a private right of action, an implied private right of action, I think sticks more to the traditional non-legal meaning of implied, which means that the person who spoke had something in mind when they spoke. The private right of action I was talking about a minute ago, the implied right of action that does not appear anywhere in the statute, and there's no indication of it in the statute. If at all, it's implied by circumstances. But even that, I think, is being generous in most cases. I think usually the parties are reaching to suggest, well, it's not there in the statute, so let's just say it's implied, but it's just not there. It's nowhere to be found.
So I guess the question is, if that's the one that you characterize as one that rings bells, the question is there at least a faint ringing of a bell here? Because under this statute, as compared with the False Claims Act, for example, there's no articulation of a lot of things that we would expect there to be if Congress meant to confer a cause of action. Whereas the False Claims Act has a lot of provisions that tell you exactly how that claim is going to be brought and how it's going to be processed through the courts. There's none of that here. What you have is a provision that says that insofar as there's a forfeiture, one half of the forfeiture will go to the individual informer. But beyond that, there's nothing that sets out the parameters of any cause of action.
That's true, Your Honor. When I first saw the case, bells went off. But if you look at the cases, discussing the informer statutes, I mean, we don't have statutes like this anymore. Congress doesn't legislate in this way anymore. Today, when Congress legislates, you'll have a definitional section. You'll have an offense. You'll have, if there is a private right of action, you'll have a section providing private right of action. We're talking about a statute that's 220 years old. And if you read...
I think that to me, if I knew nothing else about what the Supreme Court had said in this area, would be the makings of a pretty strong argument. It seems to me what makes it more difficult for you is that the one thing that Alexander versus Sandoval seems to tell us to do is not to look at what we think the state of the law was at the time that the statute is created that assertively gives rise to a cause of action. What we're supposed to do is look at the state of the law now and apply the current state of the law back in time.
Okay, that's true, Your Honor. However, we have the benefit of 200 years. The last 100 years have been relatively silent. We have it. The Supreme Court spoke to this in Vermont Agency, and they reaffirmed the dicta. Now, let me talk about dicta for.
So in Vermont Agency, dealt at least in part with the standing to bring the action, and found that standing, I think, because there had been an assignment, statutory assignment, but an assignment by the United States to the informer, to the claimant in that case. Is that not correct?
That's true, Your Honor.
Now, in this case, if there has been an assignment, it takes a further reach to get the implication of the assignment, and it would appear that the United States, if there is any such assignment, has withdrawn it by its conduct with reference to the case.
If Your Honor is asking a few questions, which should I address first?
Okay. Start with, how do you have standing?
How do we have standing? I think standing is based on the same mechanism as in the False Claims Act.
In Vermont,
statutory assignment.
All right, statutory assignment.
Yes.
Now, if there's a statutory assignment in this case, it takes a reach to get to that statutory assignment, doesn't it? Since, as my colleague points out, there's no procedure later.
This is the way Congress spoke when they wrote the statute. And the Supreme Court, if you look at Marcus v. Hess, which is the first Supreme Court decision to address this head on, the court was dealing with the False Claims Act. And the appellant, the petitioner, was arguing that informer statutes are disfavored, mm-hmm. and therefore the False Claims Act should be very narrowly construed. Mm-hmm. And the court rejected that proposition, and the court said that informer statutes have been in existence since the founding. And the first informer statute that the court cited was the Neutrality Act, which does not explicitly provide a private right of action.
But Vermont Agency finally squarely dealt head-on with the question of standing to bring the cause of action and based it in an assignment theory, right?
It's an assignment theory.
Now, if that assignment theory is the basis of standing, can the assignment be withdrawn? Or is the United States forever bound by that assignment?
The assignment was made legislatively, not by the executive branch.
Can the executive branch withdraw it?
No.
They cannot?
They cannot.
Can they not, at least under our constructions of key TAM, disavow the case effectively?
So
granted, under the statute, you can go further than the United States, but we have the cases where the United States has come in and dismissed the case.
Well,
we've upheld that, haven't we?
The United States in this case has tried to, has walked a very fine line. The United States in this case didn't come in and say, like the United States did in Olivier, Venus, we don't want this case going forward on the merits.
Have the benefit of the key TAM statute in this case. The procedure for the United States adoption entry is not there in the statute, right?
That's right.
If the United States simply disavows the case, does that amount to a withdrawal of assignment?
If the United States simply says we don't want to have anything to do with
right.
it, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
What the United States has done here, though, they haven't said we don't want this case to go forward. They said you don't have a private right of action. They're not addressing the merits. They're not saying whether there was a criminal violation or not a criminal violation. And by the way, the informer provision is separate, as the Supreme Court held in the Three Friends. It's completely separate from the criminal violation. But what the United States has done here, they've said the district court asked the United States for a statement of interest on this question of standing. The United States said there is standing. However, there's no private right of action. That's all the United States ever said. And I'm suggesting, and we say in our brief,
But we have to assure ourselves that they're standing, obviously. And I guess it's a little bit tricky to figure out in this case. But if Stevens requires that there be an assignment of the United States' interest in order to confer standing on someone who otherwise doesn't appear to suffer injury of the kind that we usually require under Article 3, how do we know that there's been that kind of assignment here, especially when there's no express cause of action, which the two inquiries merge to some extent?
Well,
we do have to address standing first.
I think they do, but I think the Supreme Court brought, there were two footnotes that are relevant, or at least in Stevens, Vermont agency. One is footnote 6, which discusses statutes that expressly provided for a right of action. The other one is footnote 7. Both were brought. The court was reached out and it said, is there really standing here? And the court said, well, let's see if this is there a case or controversy. Right? And case or controversy, the court said, is determined. We look to the history of what was meant by a case or controversy. And when the court did that, it brought two different groups of cases in support of a case or controversy. One were the informer statutes that expressly provided a right of action, and the other, in footnote 7, are the informer statutes that do not expressly provide a private right of action. And the court brought both of those in support of its ultimate holding, which brings me to another point, Your Honor, which is that this is considered Supreme Court dicta, not spoken once, but spoken twice, very recently. The Supreme Court said statutes like this are construed to provide a private right of action. I think in that statement, the court is saying they're standing, and they're saying they're construed to allow a private party to sue. The court was saying they're standing. The court was saying that there is a private right of action. The parties can sue. There's no other reason why the Supreme Court would have inserted the quotation from Marcus v. Hess in footnote 7.
I mean, in the way they treated it in Stevens, they did say suggested in dictum.
They do
and
say
so,
that. They do
I mean,
say
that's
that.
Not the, that's not the best language for you.
But it's not the best, but if I were comparing the dictum of suggested in Hess versus the dictum of repeating it, the Supreme Court didn't need to repeat it. I mean, the Supreme Court could have issued the decision without footnote 7 altogether.
But in those statutes, I guess I'm still stuck on how it is we know that the interest that the individual would assert in a circumstance like this would be the injury of the United States. Because I think what the court was doing in Stevens is at the outset it said the only way we get standing is if the individual is asserting the United States' injury, because the injury that the individual suffers him or herself doesn't have anything to do with the kind of injury we talk about in Article III terms. So they have to be addressing the injury that the United States suffers.
Yes.
And how do we know that this case fits within that exception to an otherwise absence of injury?
So if the question is about an informer statute like this, let's call it the informer provision of the Neutrality
yeah.
Act, I think that's what Stevens says. I think that's what Hess says. I think that's what Skinner says. I think that's what they weren't talking about the Neutrality Act. They were talking about statutes that were very similar. Tilden and Lasky held that here's a statute. There's no express provision of a right of action. It just says this is illegal. And if you do it, an informer can get either a fine, can collect the bounty, whatever bounty it was in each statute. And I think that's been consistently
so. So your view is that in order to find that there has been an assignment of a kind that gives rise to cognizable injury for standing purposes, we'd have to find that there's a cause of action. And not only is the finding of a cause of action necessary to find standing, but it's also sufficient. Once we find a cause of action, it's also sufficient to establish standing. Is that your perspective?
I'm not sure I'm following completely, but I do.
So do we have to find the existence of a cause of action in order to find that the individual is asserting the United States' injury? Because that's necessary.
I think for our case, there needs to be a private right of action for us to go back to the district court.
Yeah, and then if there is a private right of action, do we have to find anything more in order to find that there's the kind of injury that gives rise to standing?
That's sufficient.
You think it's both necessary?
Okay. You're agreeing that you have to be asserting the government's interest?
The government's injury.
Mm-hmm.
And not the government's interest, I'm not sure, because I think the cases like Skinner say that the government has no say. Once the action's brought, but it's the government's injury, and I think that gives rise to there's an injury to the government and the informer informs, the informer has a claim to 50% of the rest.
So can I just press you a little bit on the sufficiency part of it? The cause of action is necessary and sufficient. On the sufficient part of it, the government cites these cases in the Medicaid context. There's the Stalley case from the Sixth Circuit and another one from the Second Circuit. At least in those cases, it wasn't sufficient because there was an express cause of action. But then the point was that the express cause of action didn't give the individual a right to recover for the United States' injury, and therefore there's no standing under Stevens.
Well, under Stanley, there was an express right of action, but it wasn't an informer statute. It wasn't a QTAM. Uh-huh. That's what the court said. This is not a QTAM action.
I see. So you're – I see.
Under
so
Connecticut – under – I'm sorry. What is it? Connecticut agency – no, not Vermont agency. Connecticut.
I mean, they are informer statutes, right, in some sense, at least loosely described, because I take it the point of those is so that the individual can lay bare some
– But every one of this – Connecticut action now, that's the one. And every, if you look at the government's brief, they you know, followed the rules of the court and put an asterisk next to the key cases. Every single one of those cases is the kind of informer statute that I was speaking about, the kind of implied right of action case that I was talking about in the beginning that sets off the bells. These are the cases where Congress gave no indication, and there's no indication by the circumstances, by Congress, by the courts, that those these are just violations. These are just statutory violations and nothing more. And some creative plaintiff came along and said, I'm going to state a cause of action here. And the court said no. There's not one, none of the cases that the government cites are like the Neutrality Act, the informed version of the Neutrality Act, where you have, I see the amount of time, but they're not like the informer provision of the Neutrality Act, where you have the Congress saying an informer is entitled to a 50% bounty. And even in...
So that's the key distinction for your purposes, is that there's a sharing of the bounty.
And there's this is an informer statute. Again, we're asking for a very narrow ruling. We do not want, we're not saying courts should be creating private rights of action out of every violation in the U.S. Code. This is a statute. And I would even say that, I would even go further, that if a statute like this were written today in this way, it would be, it might be a different question. I mean, because today we know, unless there was some other indication of congressional intent, we know that Congress doesn't write like that anymore. Congress writes, they'll spell out you're less likely to find an implied right of action in a congressional statute today. Okay. But I think that this one is clear, and I think that Stevens reached with footnote 7 to reaffirm that there is a private right of action in these cases.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Vijay Shankar for the United States. Your Honors, two things are, at least in the government's view, beyond reasonable dispute in this case. The first is that Section 962 contains no express right of action, and therefore any right of action here on the part of Dr. Bauer would have to be inferred. The second is that under prevailing standards, courts today would not infer a private right of action in Section 962. It is a criminal statute with an annexed punitive forfeiture provision, and it implicates foreign relations. Now, as I understand it, Dr. Bauer's argument is that some courts 200 years ago inferred a private right of action under this statute and similar statutes. Now, I think the premise of his argument is at best dubious. I will note in connection with this that all of the relevant cases, including those cited by Dr. Bauer, had the United States listed as the captioned plaintiff. So it's clear that at some point the United States took over those actions. At most, some of those cases stand for the proposition that at the time, private individuals could seek a warrant of arrest or seizure against these ships pending the forthcoming involvement by the United States.
But what about what the Supreme Court in Stevens referred to as the dictum in Hess? So if you just look at the language in the footnote in Hess and just look at that sentence, it seems to be saying that these statutes would be construed to give rise to a cause of action.
Right. So, again, going first to the premise of Dr. Bauer's argument, I think Hess is dubious support for that. As we mentioned in our brief, it cited one case, Adams, which doesn't stand for that proposition. Adams had an expression.
Right. So I take your point that Adams actually doesn't support the statement that was made by the court in the footnote. But if you only look at the language of the footnote.
Right. So then you get to the conclusion of Dr. Bauer's argument, which I think his argument is that Hess goes to the conclusion. And I think that is also incorrect. The conclusion being, his conclusion being that if courts 200 years ago or even 50, 70 years ago, would have inferred a private right of action here, that courts today have to do the same. And that
there's not that language from the Hess footnote, regurgitated in the Stevens footnote, suggests that they've revivified those 200-year-old cases?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
Statutes providing for a reward to informers which do not specifically either authorize or forbid the informer to institute the action
are
construed to authorize him to sue.
Well, that's
the Hess language.
Right, the Hess court used...
That's not 200 years ago. That's the year I was born, is Hess, and I'm not 200 yet.
Well, even from the time you were born, Judge Santel, to now...
It's been quite a long time since I was born. But
even from that point to now, the law on private rights of action has evolved quite substantially, as the Supreme Court has
but
said.
But then you have it again cited in Stevens, which is...
Well, in Stevens, with respect, the court simply said, as Judge Srinivasan pointed out, that the court suggested in Hess, in dictum, that language.
Well, when have they said anything to the contrary? How does SOSA fit in?
Well, SOSA fits in very, very clearly, Your Honor. It involved almost it involved a very similar situation, which is a statute that at the time it was enacted in 1789, it didn't have an express right of action, mm-hmm. but under the prevailing common law standards, courts judicially created a private right of action. And the court in SOSA said, that may be the case, but we don't have to do that today because the law, the common law in this area, has changed so substantially, and it wouldn't make sense under today's standards to infer a private right of action.
Well, that is a way to read SOSA. SOSA could also be saying that in a circumstance like this, where the custom at the time of the enactment is this clear, and it's indisputable, what we have to do is to confine the reach of the cause of action to that custom, but we're absolutely going to enforce the cause of action. And then when you add Stevens to that and Hess to that, I don't see how the cause of action fails here. In the cases you're citing, I looked at all of them, and they really are patently distinguishable. I don't see how you can dismiss SOSA. SOSA doesn't say it can never happen again if we have this circumstance. SOSA says, we don't mean to suggest let's be loose now in creating implied rights of action. But if you have a SOSA circumstance again, I don't know why SOSA wouldn't apply. The court nowhere says if you find a like case again, what we're holding here, we would not hold there. I don't see that.
Well, SOSA says, does not say that you would have to do what Your Honor suggested, but it certainly allows the possibility that courts aren't bound by the common law that existed 200 years ago. And that's the same thing at the Alexander v. Sandoval case.
SOSA was not an informer statute.
That's right.
It was a tort statute. It was not an informer statute.
That's right, Your Honor. But whatever.
And it, in fact, I think SOSA says that the statute didn't create any cause of that.
Right.
That it created jurisdiction.
Right.
And that they found the causes of action at the common law of torts or the law of nations. Is that not what SOSA dealt with?
It did, and we have a similar situation.
SOSA was not really dealing with implied causes of action in a statute at all, was it?
It was still about an inferred.
Doesn't that make this a stronger case?
No, Your Honor.
You have more language here. I totally agree. The court's decision and SOSA is all over the place, but one of the things that's all over the place is this is jurisdictional. But in this case, we have stronger language when we have Stevens and Sandoval's pre-SOSA. So I don't know what to do with Sandoval. I don't think Sandoval clears anything. That's before SOSA. This case looks stronger to me than SOSA because the language is strong. You have a very long history, and you have Hess, and you have nothing post those Hess cases saying to the contrary of what those footnotes say. There's no case after that that refutes what the court says is dictum. That is, statutes providing for award to informers which neither specifically either authorize or prohibit are construed to authorize them to sue. The court's never said anything to the contrary.
Well, so I would disagree with a few of your premises respectfully, Your Honor. First, I don't believe we have stronger language here. We have an informer provision, and all the cases have made clear that this informer right is inchoate. It's derivative. It depends on a successful forfeiture. So it does not provide for a private right of action. So we are definitely in the world of inferring or having an implied right of action, not an express right of action. And I think my colleague...
No, I wasn't meaning to say that the cause of action is express as you and I understand it. No, I understand it.
Right. So
I'm saying the language looks stronger to me here than it did in SOSA. I would struggle less as a judge working with this language than I would have struggled in SOSA to get the cause of action.
Okay, but the other issue I would raise is that the history is not as strong as my colleague would have the court believe. the courts that he, the cases that he cites, all involve the United States as the prosecuting plaintiff. He has cited to no case in which an individual party in name has brought a successful forfeiture action against vessels. And all of the cases, including cases involving analogous statutes like the confiscation cases cited in our brief, talk about the right being inchoate. And the informer, the statute in the confiscation cases was a Civil War statute, but it was virtually identical to the statute here. They all say a private party cannot bring the action, cannot be involved in the action. So were
some of those cases ones in which they might have been with the United States as the named party, but they were actually instituted by the individual?
Well, again, the Skinner case arguably suggests that at the time, again, the history is, it was very different back then, but at the time, a private individual could, in some cases, institute the action by seeking an arrest warrant from the marshal. The marshal would then have to execute the arrest warrant, and then, and I cited a law review article in our brief that suggests that even in the Skinner case, the proceedings then had to go to the grand jury.
So is it an individual instituting a criminal prosecution? Is it, or a functional
analog? It depends
analog?
On how you define the institution of a criminal prosecution. Of course, we didn't. If it was before the grand jury process, then I would say no. The individual commenced some sort of claim against these ships, which then had to be joined or further executed by the United States through the criminal process. I'm just not aware, even going back all this way in history, of any instance in which an individual, a private individual, can bring a criminal prosecution. There's just no history for that, and there's certainly no history for that in the past 150 years.
Well, you're assuming the action by the informant is criminal. I don't think that's what the case law is saying. There is a criminal aspect to this, yes, but I think there's case law that says that what the private claimant would be seeking is civil, not criminal.
It's a civil forfeiture, Your Honor.
Yes.
I agree with that. But civil forfeiture is still an action brought by the government to transfer the ownership of property to the government on the ground that the property was involved in or the proceeds of a crime. And the statute says that every such vessel is subject to forfeiture. The elements of the statute, the criminal elements of the statute, would still have to be satisfied. Now, it would be in a civil forfeiture proceeding, but
which,
I'm also
which
not...
Which could be initiated, as in Skinner, by the private claimant.
I'm not aware of any, certainly in the modern era, of any case
no,
in which...
No, but Skinner, right?
Again, Skinner did require, as I read the case and as a law review, as a professor read the case, as still requiring the United States to bring the action to the grand jury. The United States is a named plaintiff in that action, Your Honor. My colleague hasn't cited to a single case that echoes the caption in this case, which is a private party single-handedly bringing an action, a forfeiture action, against private property. It's just unprecedented. Forfeiture is a government action by definition, and I think all the case law is consistent on that, and the statutes, the forfeiture statutes, are consistent on that.
Then what did the Supreme Court mean with that sentence in Hess?
Your Honor, I think it's an incorrect statement. I think it's dictum, and I think it need not be followed, not only for being incorrect, unsupported by Adams, not only for being dictum in a footnote, but also because, as we said, even if we take at face value that dictum, that at the time such statutes were construed to allow private individuals to bring the action, courts do not have to still follow that today. Those are judicially created common law rights of action. And the common law has changed over time. Courts are not bound by that common law that existed 50 or 100 years ago.
So can you help with this question of if we assume that, for present purposes, that the statute doesn't have a cause of action, just for our purposes of argument, does that go to standing or does that go to the merits?
Well, it's very difficult, Your Honor. I think our footnote 4 sets out the complexities of this issue, and I think as Your Honor pointed out, the two issues do dovetail.
The thing I didn't quite understand about your footnote 4 is that I think the standing cases that are discussed in footnote 4 deal with zone of interest standing.
Yeah.
And zone of interest standing, at this point, it's clear goes to the merits. But Stevens deals with Article III standing.
And it's not zone of interest standing anymore. It's just zone of interest.
Right. Yeah. It's because it goes to the merits.
Right.
The locution is even different.
Right.
And
right. But I think if a party has no private right of action, then they're out of court. Whether you call it standing or not, I think is...
No, that's not right. That's not right, because you can forfeit the argument. You can't if it's jurisdictional. It's importantly, that's the whole point of our board.
Well, yes.
If a party has a cause of action, they're out of court. No, only if you raise it.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. But okay. What I'm saying is if a district court finds that rules that a party has no private right of action.
Pursuant to an objection from a timely filed objection.
Sure, okay. Your Honor. But what I'm saying is the district court at that point does not have to reach the standing inquiry.
But I wonder, for our purposes, I wonder if it doesn't matter, actually, because if we think, again, hypothetically, that there's no standing, then it's not clear to me that we can affirm. In other words, at least there's some law to the effect that in that kind of situation where a district court reaches the merits, concludes that they're standing, reaches the merits, dismisses on 12b-6, then the appellate court, if it concludes that there was no jurisdiction, vacates because you want to assure that there's no res judicata effect of the decision below. In the other way, if it was a 12b-1 dismissal and you want to affirm it on 12b-6, that we can definitely do. But where it's flipped, where the district court concludes that there is jurisdiction but then dismisses on 12b-6, I think you tell me if I'm wrong, but I think it may be an open issue as to whether what we should do in that situation, if we conclude that there's no standing, is affirm or alternatively vacate to make sure that the decision below doesn't have any res judicata implications.
No, and I want to add to that question. I don't know that we have the authority to go to the cause of action question if there's no standing. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this is, if this is right, that there's no standing, I don't think we can avoid, this is not one of those exceptional threshold issues where we can skip the jurisdictional question. If there's no standing, don't we have to decide it?
That may be.
I mean, that part of Steel Co. is still alive.
Yeah. Right, right.
In which case, we can't treat them as just the same question. Is the upshot, I think, is that I don't think we can just say no harm, no foul. Either way, the plaintiff's out of court. I think it matters the reason why.
Right. I think that may be right, Your Honor.
And then why is there no standing? I want to make sure I understand what your principal argument would be. What is your principal argument?
The principal argument on the lack of standing is that to the extent the informer has an interest here, it is, again, a derivative interest. The suit would be on behalf of the United States at most. But I don't even agree with that. The informer's interest is derivative and inchoate. It depends on the existence of a forfeiture and then to which the informer is then entitled to one half. At most, an informer has an interest in this situation if there is a forfeiture and the informer is not paid half, in which case the informer's interest would be under a civil action against the United States. I'm not suggesting that there is such an action, but that would be the informer's interest in that situation. There's no separate independent standing to bring an action here in the name of the United States to receive half of something that has not yet been transferred to the United States.
But why is that materially distinct from the QI-TAM situation, where we know that they're standing, and the reason we know they're standing is because the individual's vindicating the United States' injury?
Well, because in the QI-TAM situations, Congress has basically provided for standing.
Congress can't create.
They can't create, yeah. We're going around.
They can't create a claim under which somebody has standing. And right. What I read Stevens is saying is that the United States has assigned its claim to the relator, and therefore there is standing. But
right,
I think Hodel or, no, it's not the right one, but any one of the NRDC maybe cases says Congress cannot create standing.
No, they don't create standing, I agree, Your Honor, but through the operation of the QI-TAM statute that creates the interest in the defendant that provides standing. And what I'm saying is this statute here is not analogous.
What's the interest in the QI-TAM apart from the government interest?
Well, it's an It's an interest. It's not the statute creating standing, but it's an interest created by the statute.
Well, you have an interest created by this statute, too. I mean, I'm not now.
My argument is that we don't, Your Honor, because this isn't analogous to the QI-TAM statute.
Yeah, but now I'm trying to figure out why you think it's not analogous.
Because the statute provides only for a recovery. In a QI-TAM situation, for example, and I'm no QI-TAM expert. I'm in the criminal division, so I say this with some caveats, but as I understand it, in the QI-TAM situation, even if the United States declines to participate, there are provisions set forth that allow the private individual to proceed with the lawsuit under certain circumstances, again, of which I'm not an expert. There are interests there that exist separate and apart from the pure interest of the United States. In this statute, we have a forfeiture by definition.
You're just saying you don't know what those interests are in the QI-TAM case. Because that's what's on our mind. What are the interests that are separate, that give the person standing?
The interest, among other things, is the right to bring the action even if the United States doesn't participate under certain circumstances.
Yeah,
but here, we don't have, if there's no forfeiture and a transfer of property to the United States, there is no interest by the informer. They are entitled to one half of forfeited proceeds. If there's no forfeiture, there is no interest by the informer. And only the United States can bring a forfeiture action.
Okay. One more, and it may be picky, but there was a reference to whether we should vacate or affirm. Given that the judgment below is dismissal, would it not still be an affirmance even if we do it on Article III grounds rather than 12B6 grounds?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, I think so. And that's what we suggested in our footnote 4. Thank you.
Thanks. Does counsel have time remaining? We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I think the first thing I need to address is the court's concern about standing, because that seems to be the big question here. And again, I'll reiterate that I think when Stevens dealt with the private right of action, well, Stevens was dealing with standing. When Stevens dealt with standing, it cited this, not this statute, because this wasn't from the first Congress, but it's in footnote 7, it said a number of decisions dealing with statutes from the first Congress were construed to create an implied right of action. So it wasn't dealing with this particular statute, it was dealing with this type of statute. And it held, and it brought these statutes as support for the proposition that there is standing under the False Claims Act. And so I think I think the dictum in Stevens goes to support standing very strongly in this case as well. And also, the government suggested that the dictum in Hess is questionable and said that it's dubious, the authority is, the premise is dubious. This court has said numerous times, considered Supreme Court dictum is binding. And I mean, you know, when I was writing my brief, I had, you know, sometimes you have writer's block, sometimes you have research block. I didn't find those cases when I was writing the brief, but last week I went through and I had the right words. I heard it from an oral argument here, considered Supreme Court dictum is binding. And that's what we find in Stevens, and that's what we find in Hess. Whether Hess interpreted the precedents rightly or wrongly, that was considered Supreme Court dictum. It was bringing the case, it was bringing the Neutrality Act as support for the proposition that the informer statutes and actions by informers are not disfavored. And what was the first statute? There were a number of informer statutes still on the books at the time. But the statute the court chose to bring was the Neutrality Act. And in Skinner also, I think that decision could have supported the False Claims Act standing very easily without reaching for footnote 7. But the court did.
Well, what about the point that the United States is the plaintiff?
The United States is the plaintiff. So I would say that first there's Olivier v. Highland, which the government relies very heavily on, that said, where the decision says that a seizure is made upon the complaint of the informer. We have other cases. We have the City of Mexico, where the crew made a complaint. Again, this was before a consular officer, not before a court. But the crew made a complaint, and that's how the forfeiture was affected, by the complaint of the crew. I think Skinner, the United States is a party. It was a criminal prosecution, but here we're not involved with the criminal prosecution. We're involved with the civil forfeiture. The other...
Right, so the question is whether you have to be, because, I mean, one way to read the language in Hess is it says, statutes providing for reward to informers which do not specifically either authorize or forbid the informer, which do not either, either authorize or forbid the informer to institute the action are construed to authorize him to do so. So the authorization only goes to whether the informer is authorized to institute the action, whatever that action is.
So
it's not to say necessarily, even if we take this considered dictum as you call it to be, to govern us, even, and let's just say hypothetically, for purposes of this question, we are, then all it's saying is that the individual is authorized to institute the action.
So what I would say here is that the government hasn't come in and opposed it. The government has come in and said and offered, it's essentially an advisory opinion, the same way Congress can't create standing, the government, executive branch, can't take away standing, and they can't take away a private right of action that Congress has created. The government may be entitled to an opinion, but it hasn't expressed
it yet. The problem is the cause of action and standing are not precisely the same. You remember Steel Co.?
I don't.
Because, I mean, it's a curious question here. In that case, the party brought action for failure of someone to file forms, and the case mooted out because they filed the forms, the defendant filed forms. And there's a penalty provision. The penalty only went to the government. It was payment to the government only. And so the question could be, in a case like that, and I'm trying to think of the analogies, in a case like that, could Congress enact a provision that said, in that circumstance where it's past wrongdoing, so there's no current harm to anybody, you can bring a cause of action to sue for fines that go only to the government?
There's no assignment.
There's no assignment.
That's the struggle with this case.
Even know more than that, because in Stevens, the court says it wouldn't be enough if you had the stake of a wager.
Right.
Or at least you'd have some stake. You'd have a wager on the case. But even that wouldn't be enough for Article III purposes, because you have to have the United States' injury assigned to you.
Right.
But here there was an assignment. I'll say that even if it's true that the United States could come in and oppose this on the merits and seek dismissal, they haven't done it. They've given an advisory opinion that there's no private right of action, which is not the same thing. And I think the government needs to, if it wants to oppose it on the merits, it needs to say that. It can't.
Thank you.
I appreciate your tempered argument. It's helpful for the court not to overstate, and you haven't overstated. That's very useful.
Thank you, Your Honor.